Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Michael Dello Iacovo. Michael is a PhD candidate in space science. He's looking at off-Earth exploration, mining, and asteroid impact risk. Michael hosts his own podcast, Morality is Hard, where he examines ethical questions and argues that everyday ethical choices are harder than we think they are. He's currently on the New South Wales State Committee for the Animal Justice Party, sits on the National Policy Committee, and is a committee member of the party's youth wing. Michael has dedicated his life to giving back and making the world a better place for all sentient beings. To that end, in 2016, he pledged to donate all of his income, above $45,000 each year, to the most effective charities and causes, a pledge which he will uphold with his parliamentary income if elected. Michael was previously CEO of Effective Altruism Australia. I'd love to know what you think of this conversation and the podcast as a whole, so why not write a review or give us some stars on your listening platform? You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll also be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested in the idea, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hey, Jamie, very good. How are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks. I'm loving the background. I'm feeling peaceful and meditative already. So,
well, that's good.
Thank you so much for making the time to join these sentientist conversations.
It's my pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much for reaching out.
Yeah, it's good to finally have the chance to talk. This is as close as we'll get to in real life for the moment, but maybe once we've knocked this virus on the head, one day we'll get the chance to meet in person and continue nice. The conversation over a beer. So this series of conversations are really trying to address the two deepest philosophical questions: what's real and what matters. And the simple worldview that I'm trying to develop and popularize and build some community around on sentientism answers those two questions by saying, when we think about what's real and what to believe, we should take a naturalistic approach that uses evidence and reason broadly defined to form our beliefs. And when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name, that we should use sentience, the capacity to have subjective experiences, to suffer and flourish, to set our moral boundaries. And essentially, we should include and have compassion for all sentient beings. That's it. But in these conversations, I'm talking to people who disagree with that philosophy, as well as people who agree with it. So it'll be fascinating to see where their conversation goes. But before we get to those two questions, for people who don't know you and your work, how would you best introduce yourself?
Sure. Okay. So I'm doing a few things at the moment. I actually just finished my PhD in space science.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I say I finished. I've submitted my thesis. I'm not confirmed yet. I still need to wait for the reviewers to accept the thesis. Assuming they do that though, then my thesis should be done. So I was looking at how we can use geophysical techniques that we use in, say, resource exploration, environmental engineering on Earth, but apply those to space. And in particular, looking at how we can map other planetary bodies for things like prospecting for resources, potentially in the future, whether that's ice or metals on Moon, Mars, or asteroids. And also looking at some very future, but I think critical problems such as, I guess, colonization, terraforming, and asteroid impact deflection. So just as a quick example, if we detect an asteroid coming to Earth, we would want to know what its internal structural composition is and chemical composition. Structural in particular, because that tells us about the most effective way to deflect that. So if we detected an asteroid and it was coming to Earth today, and we had about 2 years, ideally, if we had time, we'd want to land a probe on it because it could be a rubble pile, it could be a solid body. All of the different structural models that it could be dictate a different ideal deflection method. So you can imagine if you hit it with an impactor, but it's just a rubble pile, it might break up into smaller asteroids that are all still heading towards Earth, for example.
Important to know.
Yeah.
Well, you're definitely the first space scientist to come on as a guest, so it's great to have you here.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so tell us about the other threads.
Sure. So I have been involved with the Effective Altruism movement for having to just think about the number, I think 5 years, five and a bit years. Mm. So for me, I discovered Effective Altruism. I guess I was already starting to think about the ideas of effective altruism, which is just we have limited time and resources, but there's so many problems in the world and we want to do as much good as we can with our limited time and resources. And I was already thinking about those, about altruism in those terms, I guess. I would have described myself as a utilitarian for some time before that. So I'm concerned about suffering and well-being of sentient minds. I think at the time I probably was more focused on humans, but in any case, I had this opportunity to go to Nepal to volunteer and help to build a medical center. And the trip was going to cost me $5,000 because I was paying my own way to go there.
Yeah.
And helping to pay for some of the construction materials going with a charity from Australia. And I also had just finished my undergraduate degree in geoscience. And so I had a job offer and they basically said, you're free to start working whenever you like. And it was a pretty high paying job. And I just had this thought cross my mind of, I could start working now and make a lot of money, or I could go on this trip and delay working for 5 weeks and do this thing, which I think would be good. But I couldn't help but think I could pay for the $5,000 for someone else to go on this trip and then also earn enough money to send an extra person on the same trip. So I could, it's the choice between me going or two other people going was the opportunity cost. And I was thinking about this and talking to some friends and family about this, and they all thought I was just crazy. They were just like, that's ridiculous. I'm just overthinking it. Go do this thing that's going to be good, and to think about it any more than that is silly. And so I did, and I went on the trip, and I want to say I'm glad I did it. I think it was a good thing, but I just can't help but feel that I could have done more good if I'd done the other thing, which was start working full time earlier. I was very happy to discover effective altruism. So I saw Peter Singer's TED talk a few weeks after I got back from that trip, and it was just perfectly timed because I was just thinking, am I the only person who thinks like this in the world? Turns out, no, I wasn't. There was a small but growing movement that does also think like that. So that was really cool. And I've been quite heavily involved in effective altruism ever since. A little bit.
Is there a part of your utilitarian brain that still thinks that if you hadn't gone on the trip to Nepal, your mind wouldn't have been configured to really resonate with Singer's talk in a way that's led you down the path of effective altruism?
Yeah, great question.
sorry.
No, I'm happy. No, that's a good point. Quite possible, but yeah.
So much space in second and third order effects.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Things could have been better or worse, but they turned out okay. But anyway, I ended up helping to found a local chapter in Adelaide to where I was at the time. I worked for a few different organizations, volunteering and eventually in a paid role for Effective Altruism Australia. And yeah, I basically just became hooked in the movement and the ideology and the ideas in the movement. And so that kind of framework of thinking has driven a lot of what I've done ever since. So that drove the PhD, that led me to leaving my industry employment and going to do my PhD full time. And it also led me to become involved in, which is the third thing I'm involved in, the Animal Justice Party, which is an Australian political party focusing on being a voice for animals, for non-humans in parliament, and trying to make sure that legislation is made with animals in consideration. So I ran as a candidate in the New South Wales state and also federal elections last year. 2 years ago now. And I intend to run for elections again in the future and hopefully one day maybe be elected. That would be great, whether to council, state or federal. And and I guess just to round that out, I also have a blog and podcast, which I semi-occasionally keep updated, and a YouTube channel. So yeah. I just talk about science and ethics and whatever I feel like talking in those.
Yeah. And the podcast is Morality is Hard.
That's right.
Yeah. It ties in nicely with the conversation today. We'll see whether we come to some easy or difficult answers. Thank you. Fascinating range of contributions. So the first question I like to ask in these conversations is, what's real? And for many people, that's a conversation about whether they grew up in a religious or a spiritual household or one with a more naturalistic or atheistic worldview. You can wind the clock back as far as you like, but it will be interesting to know your story there and also where you've got to now on the sort of supernatural, naturalistic view or varieties thereof.
Yeah. So I grew up Catholic, Christian, and I guess this is not something I realized at the time, but many years later, after I had eventually decided I was an atheist, I realized that my parents weren't really religious. Their parents were very religious, which is why I was baptized. And I'm not sure how much of an influence that was into sending me to I went to a private Jesuit Catholic school.
Yeah.
Very religious. I don't know. Yeah. How much of that was influenced by my parents being very religious. But anyway, so I think I just took it for granted that there is a God and it's the Christian God and that's it. And you do what you're supposed to be told or you don't go to heaven. And yeah, I just, I went through basically from year two to year 12 of school, just being taught that every day and assuming that, just taking that for granted. And then after I left school, I started to think about it a little bit more and eventually came to the conclusion after a few years, which was very difficult for me, but I just realized that I did not think it was any of it was true.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a tough part of my life, but I think I'm all the better for it coming out the other side of it. But I guess, yeah, to go back to your question, I grew up for pretty much until I was 19 thinking that what's said in the Bible is just true. And I just took it for granted and never really questioned it.
It sounds like it was more of an evidence and a fact and an epistemological questioning in your mind going, whether it was the inconsistencies or lack of evidence that sort of led you to think it's not true. Was it more that, or what were your thoughts on the sort of ethics that were layered into Catholicism? Was that a factor as well, or is it more, it just doesn't feel like it's true anymore?
It's a very good question. I think it was definitely more of the truth side of it, because I started studying science and was thinking about the questions of, is the stuff in the Bible true?
Yeah.
And through that lens of science. And I just, through that, I came to the conclusion that I just can't justify it, as nice as it would be in some ways. But yeah, in terms of the ethics, I don't think that was much of a consideration for me. So it's interesting that I've never really thought about that. I've talked about my, I guess, transition from being Catholic to atheist a lot, and the ethics never really has been a big part of the conversation. So I have to say, no, not really. I look back on it with, I have some thoughts and feelings on the ethics now, but at the time, I don't think that was, so much of the consideration. It was just that I just decided I didn't think it was true. Mm. And your thoughts about ethics came later.
And what made it a difficult process? Was it social context or grandparents or family, or was it more an internal sort of turmoil of working through some things you'd deeply held before?
Yeah, it's something that I have struggled with for most of my life, but the fear of death and what happens after. Even when I was a kid and took an afterlife for granted, I would occasionally think, what if it's not real? And I'd have a panic attack thinking about what that would be like. And then I would calm myself down by saying,
more of fear that there wasn't an afterlife rather than a fear of hell or a negative afterlife.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, much more afraid of there being no afterlife than of hell. But I quickly just put my fears to ease back then by just saying, that's silly. It's definitely true. There's definitely heaven.
Yeah.
So I think that's the main thing that made it hard. Maybe even what kept me believing in it longer than I could, than I otherwise would have, just because it was quite comforting. So being faced with an uncomfortable truth and trying to come to terms with that was difficult for me, and it's something I still do struggle with today from time to time, but that's a work in progress.
And it's psychologically, it's in a way it's understandable, because, and we'll come back to this conversation later on, almost by definition our own experience is viscerally central to everything. How could it be different? It is the center of
course,
our entire experience. And look, I'm highly confident that the rest of the world exists and is really out there, and you are too. But all of that is processed here. So conceiving of that not existing at some point is a pretty strange thing to get your head around, particularly when you've grown up in a context where you're told a different story. But that's fascinating. And personally, my journey was somewhat similar. I think the flavor of religion I grew up in was also Christian, but it was softer and more background. It was a sort of anodyne Church of England type thing. And we'd go to church a couple of times a year, and it wasn't really that serious. But even with a very gentle sort of anodyne Christianity like that, it still took me quite a few years to really come to terms with it. You know, many of the people I've spoken to on this series have had much more traumatic and much more difficult experiences, because for them, the religion was absolutely central to their community. So it's not just been a psychological challenge as they think it through and work out what's real. It's also been a very real direct challenge in their societal context and in families. But even in my sort of very mild situation, it still felt like it took me a few years of a journey to work it through. It's interesting how deep it runs.
Yeah. And just on that point, I think it could be that the fact that I had left school and that's when I started questioning it could be because I had left that community. Because most of the people I went to school with and the teachers and the priests at the school were obviously believers. And so leaving that community and being exposed to the more average set of the population, I think might have been a factor. But I think the fact that I had already left the community maybe made it easier, because it wasn't like, if I was having those doubts at the time I was at school, maybe that would have been a lot harder.
Yeah. I agree. It gives you the freedom to rethink because you're in a more diverse group of people that don't have that same set of views. No, it's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. One of the other factors, and it doesn't feel like this was true for you, but one of the other factors that often holds people in a religious worldview for longer than they might otherwise stay is because not only does it provide some sort of sense of reassurance about the meaning of life and life after death and those types of things, but it also provides a moral structure too. And while, you know, it's very clear how badly religiously motivated morality can go off the rails and can warp ethics, there's also genuine compassion that runs through most religions, and some, again, sense of reassurance, right? Because there's this external deity that is the instantiation of good, right? So there's a definition, there's often lists of rules, or there are books, or there are authorities you can turn to tell you what's good and what's bad. And that structure, while I think it's totally unfounded and largely fabricated, and the good elements of it are there largely by luck and predated the religions, but there are good elements there, it's still a structure that you can lock into, particularly when your culture and your community holds on to it. So that can be another part of the difficult process of leaving a religious worldview, is that some people feel that they lose a moral foundation and that the morality loses its moorings in some sense. Was that a factor for you? And almost regardless, if, again, winding the clock back, if I'd asked you as a child, what is good and what is bad morally, what matters, how might have you have answered that question? And has that shifted over your life too?
Yeah, great question. I think I don't want to put too much confidence on this, just because I can't really remember. So yeah. I was about to say, I would have said what the Bible says is good.
Yeah.
But I think that's what I would have said, but I don't want to put too much confidence in that, just because I'm saying that because I knew I was religious back then, and that's probably what I would have said.
Yeah.
I actually can't really remember. And I think I didn't think about ethics that much, to be honest. It's just something that I guess I didn't really think about too much. It was an active thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, because for some people, it's I think at that age, they would answer the question that way. But in practical terms, their morality would be more of a sort of common sense, love your family and be compassionate and be nice, that type of stuff. And whereas for other people quite early on, they looked at those two things and said, I feel this naturally compassionate ethic, but when I read certain parts of the Bible or the Quran or whatever, that doesn't seem very compassionate. And there's a disconnect there. But it does feel like they were somewhat separate for you at that, in the early stages. There wasn't a real strong link from the ethics of Catholicism into your personal ethics. But again, we're probably reading too much into distant memories.
I would love if past Michael had a journal where he talked about this sort of thing, because I'm fascinated. I actually don't know what I thought about that. And I would have loved, I would love to have known.
So what point did you start thinking about ethics and morality, and and how would you describe grounding to what matters morally to you now?
Sure. It certainly happened at some point in the last few years, or I should say the foundation of what I think is ethical now happened in the few years following when I left my faith. And I think what happened was I was searching for meaning in a way, and I discovered the word utilitarian, and I learned about what it meant. And I just thought, just makes perfect sense. Rules make sense if there's a God or a deity making these rules, like deontology. But I think if independent of that, it has to just come down to suffering and well-being. And there has to be, some amount of good that can outweigh some amount of bad. And so I think just straight away, utilitarianism or consequentialism made a lot of sense to me. And I think I just thought about it more and more over the years, and things like the trolley problem and other thought experiments. And eventually I thought more about what can sentient minds value, or what things can sentient minds value. And I think my take on it would be, I'm not sure where I fall on the moral realism side of things. I think probably I would agree there's no such thing as moral realism, but I think that the only things that sentient minds can value is suffering and well-being. So And then everything else that we think we value is usually just a means to an end, or we're tricking ourselves, or it's some biological quirk. But if you take any non-human species and they valued suffering and well-being, and that's about it, really. And everything else comes down to that. So in a way, as humans, we have more things in between our actions and our goals, but it's still the same thing. That's, I guess, a simplified version of my take on it now. So I guess that just developed over a few years of learning about what utilitarianism is and what some other people have said about the topic. And probably Peter Singer was one of the first utilitarian authors I read. And then I've read some others since then and would largely agree with what they say on that.
Yeah, fascinating. And I feel a very similar pull. I think so many things can be morally good or bad. But when you ask, why is that good or bad? And you keep asking why, for me, you always come back to the experience of a sentient being. You always come inescapably back to suffering or flourishing, which I describe in very broad terms. I think suffering is any qualitatively negative experience, you know, so physical pain through to existential angst, through to the sense of loss, and flourishing being any positively valenced experience, right? So physical pleasure all the way through to sense of love, awe and wonder and connectedness with the universe, all of those things. Count. I think sometimes when people talk about a hedonistic approach, it can feel a bit narrow, like it's just physical pleasures and pains. But I think, you know, I share your view that it's actually there's such an incredible variety of sentient experiences that have value. But that's really where the value comes back to. And while there's a lot of obviously philosophical debate about what's the right ethical system and utilitarianism, deontology, virtue ethics, so on and so forth, in a way, sentientism, I've tried to frame it in a way that cops out of all of those difficult questions and just says, use whatever ethical system you like, but your scope of moral considerability at least has to include all sentient beings. So arguably you could be a sentientist who cares about all sentient beings, but still be a deontologist because you follow a rule that it's nice to be kind to all sentient beings, or you know, similar in virtue. But personally, I do have a more of a consequentialist outlook. So I'm nervous about some of the sort of more simplistic or mathematical forms of utilitarianism in the way that they might aggregate suffering or flourishing. And there's all sorts of complex debates to be had there. But I do think that ultimately everything comes back in terms of value to consequences for the experiences of sentient beings. So
yeah. And I guess the way I think about that is, why is it that we care about living things or sentient minds, I should say, but not a rock. I think that for something to be bad ethically, it has to be bad for someone, and it can't be bad for a rock or a spinach plant.
Yeah.
There has to be something this is the philosophical sentence they always use, but there has to be something that it is like to be that thing.
Yeah.
There's something that it's like to be a human. There's an experience. There's something that it's like to be a pig or whatever else. There's not something that it's like to be a rock or a spinach plant.
I agree. So, and it's it almost feels definitionally true or tautologically true, because in almost any, once you've put supernatural morality to one side, which defines morality as compliance with or alignment with the essence of a fictional deity, once you put that aside and you say, well, we're going to have a naturalistic morality, almost by definition, it is a concern for others, and those others have to have some valenced shift in their experience for you to care about. So it almost becomes tautological, but tautologies are true. That's why they're tautologies. So I'm nervous sometimes that it becomes, whether we're begging the question, but it also seems almost self-evidently true that if you're going to have a naturalistic morality, you ultimately care about the experiences of sentient beings. And I like to joke, and this will annoy the, you know, the virtue ethicists or the deontologists who are sentientists, but in a way, I'm a big fan of deontological rules and ethical virtues, as long as they consistently deliver positive utility outcomes. And the deontologists and the virtue ethicists, you say, why are those good rules and why are those good virtues? And it's because they think they deliver good outcomes, good consequences. Yeah, again, I like I say, sentientism stays neutral on that stuff, just because I think the most valuable thing is setting the boundary. But that's one of the other things that would be interesting, because you've already made it clear that you don't draw the boundary based on humanity and membership of our species, you think about sentience. So again, to wind the clock back, it would be great to understand your journey as to your moral circle or your scope of moral considerability, how that develops over time, how early, and what were the turning points for you?
I just want to make one comment on that. That's okay. So the way I think about it, you know, why there should be no divide between a human or any other sentient mind, is if you take it for granted that humans have value, then you think about evolution and you go back one generation of humans, they still have value. 10 generations of humans, they still have value. You keep going back and eventually different species start to merge. And unless there's some arbitrary point where suddenly humans don't have value, this is a cutoff for some reason, because you've gotten now back to the point where, let's say, humans and chimpanzees unmerged or split up, or where humans and pigs split up. I think as long as there's some sentience there, then they have to have at least some value. We can argue maybe whether individuals with less capacity for suffering or less capacity for sentience have less value. But unless there's no sentience or no capacity for pain or pleasure, there has to be some value. And yeah, I just think about it in terms of, you go up on the train of evolution and everything links back together. And if humans have value along that chain, then everything else has to have value along that chain. So I guess that's another way to come to that same conclusion.
That makes sense. Although I guess a panpsychist would challenge you and would say, okay, let's keep going back. Let's keep going back to, you know, bacteria and archaea and then random groups of organic molecules in the mud and all the way back to the electrons. And
I think there would probably be a cutoff point somewhere. I guess there'd have to be, unless I'm open to this if there's evidence for it, but unless it turns out that atoms are individually sentient. And I know that there are some people who have written about that. I don't understand it, but some people have proposed that might be the case. There could be some cutoff point, whether it's like the creation of the first neuron or something by genetic mutation or something. So maybe that's the cutoff point.
But, and personally, as a good naturalist, I remain open-minded even to ideas that intuitively feel crazy to me. But I do tend to think of sentience more as something that has happened because of a particular biological evolutionary process that's made it useful for us to have an advanced capability to monitor ourselves in an environment that happened at some point in the development of animals, but not before that, because of an evolutionary pressure that made that useful. And that, that we can then infer that through behavior and communications, but also architecture as well. So anywhere we have evidence of there being sentience, my own personally and so on, we can then infer using evolution and behavior and architecture to probabilistically, imperfectly, infer that there's sentience elsewhere as well. So I guess that's a reasonably traditional view of sentience that in practical terms would say humans, most animals, some question marks over the simplest invertebrates, no to plants, no to rocks and rivers, but open-minded. And that's my stance. And I think that even if there is a panpsychist view that says, fine, that's what sentience is, but there is still some capacity of what it's like to be about every form of information processing, even going back to electrons. Fine, I'm open-minded about that. I'm not sure how we'll ever test it. And I don't see that there was ever any evolutionary pressure that would make that come to be. But I am highly confident that even if there is that sort of what it's like to be an electron, one, it's very boring. And two, it has no moral significance, because even if you want to say that photon or that electron is conscious in this completely redefined way, I don't think it's actually sentient, because I don't think it can experience any valence to that experience. So even if there is some what it's like to be like an electron, which I seriously doubt, I don't think it really counts as sentience, because there's no suffering or flourishing there.
We're probably going down
a bit of a rabbit hole, but
definitely outside my area, so I can't comment too much. But I also then wonder, if we did find that out, how does that influence the decisions and actions that we take today meaningfully? Does it influence what we should do?
If there is information processing going on in that electron, it can't be changed anyway, because it's just an electron. And we have no capacity to affect it in a way anyway. So I think we come to the same point, which is fine, but it's morally irrelevant. So which I think brings us back to this sort of more scientific mainstream concept of which things are able to experience suffering and flourishing. But how early did you start thinking about non-humans having moral worth, and how quickly did that have an influence on your lifestyle, and was that a difficult journey as well?
Yeah, sorry, we got very off topic
there. That's my fault. I find it fascinating.
Great question. I've had companion animals growing up. We had several cats and a dog, and I cared for them a lot, but I ate animal products. So I don't know. I think the animal products might be just the case of me never questioning it and just taking it for granted and not actually thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
Again, I don't want to put too much stock in my unreliable memory. But to answer your question, so I really started to think seriously about considering all non-humans. So I first went vegetarian now about 8 years ago. Yeah, 8 years ago, I think almost. So that was mostly for environmental reasons at the time, but I had a friend who was vegan for environmental and ethical reasons. Mm. And when I say ethical, I mean specifically out of concern for non-humans.
Yeah.
So I asked, they were probably one of the biggest influences for me to be vegetarian because I was concerned about climate change. I was concerned at the time for reasons relating to humans, as in what impacts would this have on humans.
Yeah.
But I was open, I guess just the act of being vegetarian maybe made me more open-minded to thinking, okay, I'm not doing this one thing anymore. And actually maybe that one thing was like quite bad and I'm still supporting dairy and egg industries. And is that also bad? Yeah. And then after 2 years of being vegetarian, I think it happened earlier. I think I realized somewhere in that 2 years that I can't justify like eating any animal products anymore. And then it took me some time to finally make the switch. So I'd say somewhere from 5 to 8 years ago is where I really started to seriously consider not just some like domesticated animal species, but also just all non-human species. And I think quickly after that came the realization that actually insects might be sentient and that should matter. And then from there, I just kept going, I guess. I thought, oh, what if AI is sentient? Maybe we should care about that. If there's like digital minds being exploited in the future, that would be bad. Yeah. Probably. But then you get to the maybe electrons are sentient and you can just, rather than continuously having to update, you can just capture all that at once and just say, I just care about everything that's sentient.
Yeah.
So that's why I just really love the term sentient, just because it just, I know Cosmic Skeptic has said it doesn't quite roll off the tongue very nicely. And maybe.
Yeah, I was outraged. He said the term has absolutely no wit about it. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah. But I have to say it's an incredibly useful term. It's so descriptive and it just captures everything about it. It just captures everything. It means you think that sentient minds are valuable. And that future proofs you for so many, a new scientific discovery. Okay. Like your laptop is sentient. Fine. Sentient just covers that already. You don't even need to change anything. You just say, oh, okay. Yeah. I guess I care about laptops then. So yeah, it just covers all bases, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's partly why I've been drawn to it as well. And I did, when Cosmic Skeptic sent that, I sent my army of 200 YouTube subscribers after him, but I'm not sure he noticed. Nothing really happened.
No, I left a comment as well on his video.
But he's, at least grudgingly, he still says he's a sentientist. Yeah. I agree. The word's got a bit too clunky. It's got too many syllables in it. But what I like, and I share this with you, is that it has the most important defining characteristic at the center of the word. That's what it is. So like humanism is primarily about humans, although encouragingly they're stretching the definition. Sentientism is about sentience, and that fits in every context. And I also like that future proofing as well. Many people who call themselves sentientists find talking about alien sentience or artificial intelligence sentience or these other types of things an irritating intellectual distraction, because they are understandably focused on, you know, the 8 billion human sentience and the many trillions of non-human sentience that exist now and undergo enormous suffering. And I completely agree in terms of priority and focus, I'd share that. But I do think intellectually it's useful to have a term that isn't defined by substrate or species or some other irrelevant characteristic. It's defined by the one moral characteristic. And I've almost described it as, you look at all sorts of other isms, many of which are unpleasant discriminations. In a way, sentientism is the only moral discrimination, because the only things excluded are things that don't care because they can't experience anything. And any being that is capable of suffering, we put our arms around and have compassion for, whether or not we're in a position to really help. But no, that's fascinating. And I want to come on to the next stage of our conversation, because so much of your life has been focused on this topic, which is making a better world and a better universe. And so this section is thinking about the future and imagining. We're in this slightly strange position, I think, where you and I share a naturalistic worldview. The best way of understanding reality, however imperfectly, is to engage with it honestly. But most people on the planet, at least in some sense, disagree with us because they think there is some sort of supernatural or revealed or other way of knowing beyond using evidence and reason to build beliefs. And when it comes to what matters, you and I have settled, I think, very solidly on sentience as being the defining moral qualifier. You know, why should there be any type of suffering that should be excluded? Surely all of that suffering should matter in some sense. That doesn't mean the answers are easy, but at least in terms of consideration. So I think you and I both feel that those positions are pretty solid, right? We're open-minded and open to new evidence, but they seem pretty strong foundations. In a way, that's what I'm trying to do with sentientism, is say, look, let's deal with all the other complexity later, but let's focus on the easy foundational platform stuff, which to my mind should be naturalism and this focus on sentience. But yeah, nearly everybody else disagrees with us. If you imagine a situation where we could get more of the 8 billion people on the planet, who are the ones probably with the most power to shift the future, I'm not sure other species of we can rely on them too much. If we could get more people to take a naturalistic approach and have a broader circle of moral compassion, what could that future look like? Is the first question. And you can go sci-fi, distant David Deutsch style, if you like, or you can think more immediate term. And how can we get there, given that, yeah, most people do disagree with us and think we're weird?
Yeah.
This is a broad question, but...
Sure. I think there's two very different things there. And I do think they're different. And one is the naturalistic way of engaging with the world and understanding it. And one is the what matters ethically. Yeah. And I think those require two different challenges to get the world to where we'd like it to be on each of those. I don't know if I have an answer of how we can get there, except for some maybe small scale discussions. I do like the idea of expanding the moral circle and value spreading.
Yeah.
So especially when you think about the far future, and I think the far future is very important and we should care about lives that don't exist yet, and think about what we can do to influence them positively. And I think one of the things that we can consistently do to make the lives of individuals in the future better is to spread good values now. So if we imagine just spreading these values that we think are good, like naturalistic views, like caring about sentience, I think those are strong, solid bets for improving the lives of people of sentient minds in the future.
Mm.
Because a lot of other interventions are quite specific, and it's hard to even say, even if we think it's good in the short term, what's the effect going to be in the long term? We can't necessarily easily say that they're going to be positive. But I think with value spreading, there's always a case for maybe that would be bad somehow in the long run. But I just think it's a pretty safe bet to spread good values into the future. And the way we do that is just to get more people today to believe them. And then that just propagates through society into the future. Yeah,
And I'm in two minds about it. And again, there's a danger here, because that's obviously one of the things I'm focusing on with this sentientism idea. Because on the one hand, we know how difficult it is to just change people's values. Wouldn't we love it if just the force of argument was enough? For some people, it isn't. But for most people, social norms and indoctrination and habits hold them really tightly. So it's quite hard to do. But I think it is possible, but I share your intuition that in a world of moral uncertainty, what's right, what's wrong, and a moral of epistemological uncertainty, the world is a bloody complex place, and how hard it is to understand which of our interventions do good or do harm, or certainly which are best, that's really difficult. So in a way, it's a sort of copping out and saying, okay, I think sharing positive values feels like, even given those uncertainties, it should be robust, right? It should be pretty solid. It helps in the short term, should help in the long term. It should help arguably every human problem, to my mind, is caused by either a restriction of compassion or by people believing things that are poorly founded in reality. So by addressing those things, arguably you make all decisions better and you increase the chances of any political system working well, and you increase our chances of fixing any problems. Yeah, it's almost like backing away from the uncertainty, but having a robust approach that tries to improve values generally.
Yeah.
Some people will say that's a cop-out. It's hard to do. And actually, here's this very specific, you know, thing with a really obvious direct value that we should be focusing more effort on. So.
Yeah. And I think one way we can think about that is in terms of how can we expand the moral circle of consideration, is I think there's quite a large like expansion that is here on Earth that we can do potentially in the next few hundred years, which is expanding the circle into non-humans for most people. So getting most people to care about non-humans enough to say not exploit them for food and so on. I think if we were to make strides in that over the next 100 years, I think that would get us a long way to spreading that value of an expanded moral circle of consideration.
That feels like it's doable, but partly because we can be caught up in the zeitgeist in the countries we live in, where veganism and so on seem to be becoming more mainstream, and that can blind us to the fact that global meat and dairy consumption is still going up. So you don't want to be too naive, but it does feel like there's some shifts in the zeitgeist, if you like, around those ethics. But you also touched on an interesting point earlier on where actually sometimes just freeing people from that system makes it easy for them to upgrade their ethics about that system. So as alternatives to animal products become more prevalent, and as the environmental pressure pushes more people away from them and worry about zoonotic diseases, antimicrobial resistance and so on, I think for a variety of reasons, more people will end up detaching from the animal product industries, which will actually free them to then upgrade their values and think more generously about sentience, as in a way you did. Once you'd already become vegetarian for other reasons, it made it a little easier for you to challenge the system that you were less a part of. But
yeah, that seems to match my experience and also the limited psychological research that I've read on the topic. It's just helping to break down that cognitive dissonance through anything that makes it easier. If you're not participating in something for a little while, then it makes it easier to think whether that thing is wrong. Whereas when it's something you've been raised to do and to think is normal and something you do all the time and everyone does it, it's much harder to think about the possibility that's not inconsistent with your values. Yes, but that's another topic.
Yeah, yeah. And linked to that is the idea of politics in that context as well, and particularly given the role you play in, you know, standing for election and being part of the Animal Welfare Party. What role do you think politics can play in that moral circle expansion and shifting the agenda there as well? Because there's been interesting shifts within the animal advocacy movement of people like Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicker and Alistair Cochrane writing Sentientist Politics, talking about how can we actually get non-humans to be represented as well. Given your role, it'd be interesting to have a sense of how that is working and how it might work over time.
Yeah, I see it as two sides of the same coin in a sense, because we need, I'll come back to this because I don't want this to be a cop-out answer. We need both.
Sometimes that is the right answer, but
we need the people encouraging people in more of it, like grassroots organic level of behavior change. But then we also need people in parliament where major decisions are made to help make decisions with animals in consideration. And there's an example that one of our elected members, Emma Hurst, gives, which I love, so I'll just copy it. So this is partly due to people just consuming less dairy, whether that's for ethical reasons, environmental, or even health reasons if people are lactose intolerant. But plant-based milks have become a lot more prevalent over the last few decades, and they're taking up a lot larger proportion of the market share of milks. So that's good. But then in Australia, we're seeing some politicians with pressure from their, say, dairy farmer or animal agriculture base of voters, which is like a very rural, the rural base of voters, I guess. They're getting pressured to actively fight against those things, those products. So for example, things like, this is happening in the EU right now, I think, but they've talked about it in Australia as well. Things like banning the use of the word milk for things like soy milk and almond milk and so on, like those kinds of changes, and banning call them sausages anymore and that kind of thing. So if we just had the grassroots stuff going on, I think it would be harder for us to be able to block those changes, which would be like, I think a pretty big deal, at least in terms of people being able to buy plant-based milk products and that kind of thing, animal product alternatives. So I think that's a good example of why the politics side is also really important. So it's very hard because at the end of the day, you're with politics, you're still really, for the most part, you're just tied to what the public wants because you have to get elected. And so if you're honest and truthful and you say, this is what I'm going to do if elected, then you only get elected if enough people in society want that as well. So I don't think that is going to be like a major part of the biggest part of the, what's the word I'm trying to use? I don't think that's going to be like a key part of this whole picture of like sentientist politics, because what it would require also a big enough proportion of of society to hold those values as well. But in the meantime, we can get a few people elected, and especially in our parliamentary system where it's easier as a small party to get people elected in the upper house. So we can have a few people at that table helping to make those decisions. And I guess we'll take that opportunity if we can. And I think that is really impactful. And there are some levers that you could pull in parliament to to drive that more like changing mindset of society. So for example, if you could do something that would, let's say, lower subsidies on animal products or something that, that animal agriculture receives, you'd expect that to drive up the price of animal products. And that might break down some of that cognitive dissonance. If someone's thinking, well, I used to get a steak once a week, now it's expensive, maybe I'll try the plant-based steak. And that's just, that's going to come back to what we just talked about before of breaking down the cognitive dissonance. So
it feels to me there is almost a latent public support for doing this anyway. So you've probably seen some of the Sentience Institute research that was surveying the American public, and even enormous numbers of people who do consume meat and dairy every day were vociferously against particularly factory farming, but many also said that they'd like to see a complete ban on slaughterhouses. So there's almost a sort of latent public support for many of the things we're talking about, but it's trapped by social norms and indoctrination. So in a way, it does feel like there's, yes, we can continue to make the moral argument, but in a sense, that's already won. What we also need to do is just make that transition easy so that people can switch. And so that's about product availability, but it's also about, as you said, policies and standards and incentives and subsidies. And, you know, if you could shift subsidies from supporting the continuation of the animal agriculture industries towards a sort of just transition that helps, you know, farmers, farming communities, fishing communities find a new way of living compassionately that, you know, isn't based on causing catastrophic suffering and death, is enormous power we can bring to bear just through making that transition easier. Because I think there's this sort of latent sense that many more people than we might think would see that as a positive development, but it doesn't mean it's easy.
I have to say I was very surprised to see those results from the Sentience Institute. I wonder a little bit about, without getting too much into the weeds, things like, you know, how much do people really know what they're saying when they say that? Do they, have they thought about if there were no slaughterhouses, what that actually would mean? It's encouraging regardless, but I'm a little bit skeptical as to how seriously we should take those.
Yeah, how meaningful that is really in terms of behavior change.
But, but it's encouraging.
It is,
So to go back to your question before, if I can,
of course,
what I want society to look like, in terms of short term, not sure, it's tricky to say, but in terms of long term, what I want society to look like, I actually have a really clear example in mind, and that I'm a very avid consumer of sci-fi. And my favorite sci-fi series is the Culture series by Ian Banks.
Yeah, wonderful.
So I actually just want to read the synopsis, if I can, of the Culture, because I think it just perfectly encapsulates like what a nice goal for society to look like.
Yeah.
Because I see it as a utopia, the society. So it's basically an interstellar post-scarcity civilization where people, there's just not really resource pressures. Wars are quite rare because there's just not really any need. And so they hold values of peace and individual freedom as core values. And sort of the premise of the story revolves around how they, as being benevolent technocrats in a way, or just supremely technologically advanced, how they try to interact with other societies that are not as technologically advanced but don't hold the same values. So for example, they often struggle with other societies that brutalize their own members, pose threats to other civilizations, and so on. And they could come in and just change things and take over, but their values don't necessarily let them do that. And it's a fascinating series, just in the sense of you can start to think about some ethical problems of how would society operate when there's no more scarcity, when there's no more money, and when major decisions are made by AI that are just super advanced and have the best interest of all sentient minds in mind, what kind of things happen and how different does society look? So yeah, I would definitely encourage anyone interested to go and read one of the books, because I think it's just a perfect example of how society would, I find it unlikely and unrealistic actually, but I think it would be great if we did get there.
Yeah. And I think at the risk of annoying all any philosophers who have been my guests and who are watching or listening, but often I find there's better quality philosophy in science fiction than there is in many philosophy papers. And that's partly because I think sci-fi does free us to think in unconstrained ways about possibility. And that also means you have to focus back on fundamental values as well, and in quite an interesting combination. Yeah. And while a lot of people look at sci-fi and just think it's crazy and conceptual and impossible. I think at least as a thought experiment, it's interesting. But also I'd encourage people not to underestimate our capabilities. You know, if you talk to someone in the 1400s about the way we live our lives today, they tell you you're totally crazy. So who knows where we might be able to get to. And part of what makes me think that way is that while there are so many deeply intractable, awful problems we're facing today, in some situations, the answers are actually pretty obvious and straightforward. And if we could just lock in and agree on them and do them, you can imagine us being able to make phenomenal progress in some ways. But there are different schools of thought about whether, because of the importance of that long-term future, we should focus very narrowly on specific topics or hinge points or areas that will either protect us from risks in the long-term future or establish a strong, positive long-term future. And others that are more broad-based, and I think my instinct is here, that the best way of locking in a strong, positive long-term future is actually to free the, you know, intellect and emotion and compassion of more of the 8 billion highly capable humans today, so that we can, with better values, solve problems, manage risks, and lock that future in. So I find this, I'm always hesitant about the slightly more elitist focused approaches on the long-term future. And I tend to come back to my instinct of let's make today better as a way of improving the long-term, but there's different schools of thought there too. So
yeah.
We're just about coming up on the hour. I mean, that's been a fascinating run through your perspective on your own personal philosophical journey and some thoughts about the future as well. Are there any other things you'd like to lay into that vision of the future before we start to wrap up? Or
I can't really think of too much I'd want to add, but I just want to say thank you, because this has actually been quite interesting for me as well. And you've compelled me to think about some things that I'd actually have never thought about, which has been great for me as well. Hopefully your listeners get some value out of it. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've got too much to add. I hope that as a priority, we can expand these values of caring about all sentient minds to other people. And if we can't do that, then hopefully we can at least get some policies and behavior change that looks the same, even if the motivations aren't necessarily where we want them to be. But if, you know, we can, through other measures like market or something else, encourage the behavior that we like, that we want, then I guess I'll take that as the second best.
Yeah. And of course, all of that's for naught if we get hit by an asteroid. So thank you for your work managing those existential and catastrophic risks as well, so that we can hopefully keep making some progress.
I try. Thank you.
It's been great to have you on. Thank you for helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking in a minor way, at least. It's been a fascinating conversation. The best way of people, you've mentioned already your podcast and your blog and your YouTube and your political work. What's the easiest way of people following you and keeping up to date with your work? And I'll include all the links, of course, in the notes.
Oh, cool. Okay. So I think the key one would just be my website/blog, which is michaeldello.com. I think everything is linked to from there, but probably the other main platforms would be my YouTube channel, which is Vegan Space Scientist on YouTube, and my podcast, which is Morality's Heart. But that's all linked from the website anyway, so you can get to that from there.
That's great. Michael, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and I've enjoyed being in the forest with you for an hour. So,
Oh, thank you so much, Jamie. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?